Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Okay, reading from Cosmos Magazine, issue number 82, copyright somewhere in 2019, which is this year. It's actually not very clear on the cover what the exact date is. I think now biennial aspect of it. I'm just going to read, there's a letter from the director. And we have a new look, Royal, what's it called? Royal Institution of Australia. So it's the Royal Science one. And we're just going to have to quickly go through and read this magazine from beginning to end. So it's Digest Science you might have missed. Curiosity says hi from Mars. When you're on a big trip, you've got to let friends know. NASA's Opportunity rover may be dead, but its sibling, Curiosity, is still keen on a quick selfie. It took this happy snap in late January at Rockhall drill site located on Mars, Vera Dublin Ridge. In fact, there are 57 individual images here, all taken by the Mars hand lens imager, then stitched together into a panorama. Well, I don't know quite know how it did actually do this. It looks as though there's an image here. So, I didn't understand the Opportunity is dead, but the Curiosity is still going. The scene is dustier than usual. NASA says it's due to a dust storm. So you can see the dust at the back. Here's another thing. Is it Planet 9 or a massive disk? There's another suggestion for what's causing some unusual orbital architecture. So are those mystery orbits in the outermost reaches of the solar system caused by an unknown ninth planet? There are another group of astronomers suggesting the answer is no. They believe it can be explained by the combined gravitational force of small objects orbiting the sun beyond Neptune. Quote, the Planet 9 hypothesis is a fascinating one, but if the hypothesis ninth planet exists, it so far has avoided detection, says Anthony Salfani from the University of Cambridge in the UK. In the paper published in the Astronomical Journal, Salfani and colleagues suggested there's a disk made up of small icy bodies with a combined mass as much as 10 times that of Earth. When combined with a simplified model of the solar system, the gravitational forces of the disk can account for the unusual orbit and architecture exhibited by some objects in the outer reaches of the solar system. Theirs is not, they concede, the first theory involving such a disk. It is the first, they say, which explains significant features of the observed orbits while accounting for the mass and gravity of the other eight planets in the solar system. I guess it's gone down. Ancient burrowing bat found in New Zealand. It's not big, but it's the biggest yet described. Scientists have discovered an ancient giant burrowing bat related to New Zealand's endemic burrowing bats, and the first new genus added to the country's fauna in 150 years. The bat's teeth and bones are discovered in a 16 to 19 million year old settlements near the towns of St. Bethans by an international team led by researchers from the University of New South Wales. It was named Vulcanops geniwortherae, after the team member, Jenny Worth, who discovered the fossils, the Vulcan, the mythological Roman god of fire and volcanoes. With the estimated weight of just 40 grams, Vulcanus was hardly a giant, but three times the size of living burrowing bats in New Zealand today, the largest burrowing bat yet described. New Zealand's burrowing bats are so called because they are distinctly terrestrial lifestyle. They forage for insects and fruits and flowers while running about on all fours and roosting in small burrows created by leaf litter or logs or seabird's nests. Burrowing bats are the most closely related to bats living in South America than to others in the Southwest Pacific, says the New South Wales Susan Hand, who is different from the Jenny Worth. Quote, they are related to vampire bats, ghost face bats, fishing and frog-eating bats, nectar-feeding bats, and belonging to the bat superfamily that once spanned the southern London masses of Australia, New Zealand, South America, and possibly Antarctica. Findings are published in the paper of the New Zealand paper of science. Okay, now the oldest jewellery in Europe. Here I'm going quite well. Now, we've got a picture here of these beautiful artifacts, paired artifacts, that they are just exquisite, and they've got little holes for jewels that look like earrings. 1 centimeter, it's to scale. It's most beautiful. Excavations in Russia add to the lives of the mysterious Denisovians. I don't think from my reading that they know that they're Denisovians. They could be Neanderthals. It's interesting, Neanderthals had fire, clothes, weapons, tools, homes, organization, planning ahead. They had everything so close to what modern humans are. So it's a bit, a bit prejudiced, knocking out Neanderthals. This is a collection of bone points and pierced teeth found from the Denisovania cave in the Bashlysky range of the Altai Mountains in Siberia, Russia. Now, Denisovian scales is because there used to be a hermit who used to live in the cave. It was retrieved by researchers led by Catherine Duca of the University of Oxford. The cave is highly significant because the evidence shows it was inhabited at times perhaps simultaneously by Neanderthals and the little-known hominids known as the Denisovians. In papers published in the journal Nature, scientists report the Denisovians occupied the cave between 287,000 to 55,000 years ago, while Neanderthals lived there between 193 and 97,000 years ago. So Neanderthals were interlopers. Dates calculated by the two groups of researchers don't completely agree. Although they are wildly divergent, Duca's team calculated the bone of the tooth artifacts date between 49 and 43,000 years ago. Okay, well, that would mean the Denisovians. This makes the oldest such artifacts so far found anywhere in northern Eurasia and possibly of Denisovian origin. Very interesting. Why they say that? So, yeah, I find that really hard to understand how they can get more recent. Because I think it's why so far they've only got one fossil section. Is the chicken the most potent symbol of our time? The modern broilers are wholly technologically dependent species. The humble chicken, Gallus gallus domesticus, is the actual symbolic product of humanity's influence on the planet, researchers claim. With sheer numbers of the bird and the changes to its height mass brought on by specialized breeding programs in Asia in the 1950s vividly symbolize the transformation of the biosphere to fit the evolving human consumption patterns. According to the lean team led by Karis Bennett of the UK's University of Leicester, writing the journal Royal Society of Open Science, they suggest the modern domesticated chicken serves as a solid evidence for the classification of the current period of the world history as Anthropocene, which means, you know, that we've influenced the climate. The time denotes a time in which the Earth is wholly dominated and largely reconfigured by humans. It is controversial, however, with some scientists feeling that it's more to do with pop culture than empirical evidence. Even among those who feel it has merit, debate rages over when the Anthropocene began. Estimates range from 900 CE to 1950. Bennett and their colleagues favour the more recent end of the spectrum and cite a key mark in the post-award event of Chicken of Tomorrow competition launched by US Atlantic and Pacific supermarkets chains to encourage farmers to breed a fatter bird. Since then, researchers... Isn't that amazing? The Chicken of Tomorrow, my God. Since then, researchers write, chickens have undergone extraordinary changes from mid-20th century to the present. Broiler growth rates have been soared with up to fivefold increase in individual biomass. My God, modern chicken is, in fact, a wholly anthropogenic species, with its survival utterly dependent on technological intensive meat treatment production. In the US, 97% of broiler hens are reared in factory farms, and worldwide the figure drops only to 72%. Wow, so the thing is, you could eliminate a chicken, but it would not survive. DNA sugar can form in space, experiments show. Oh, gee whiz. A lab adds to the evidence that extraterrestrial organic compounds may have seeded life on Earth. Well, it's a bit weird. Laboratory experiments have shown that sugar is critical to the structure of DNA, which is so dinucleic acid, dioxynucleic acid. It's ribose with the oxygen moving ribose is a sugar, a 6-ring sugar, 5-ring sugar with an extra, but six carbons, but 5-ring. And the ring is a sulfacid, an acid cycle. The result adds to evidence organic molecules can form under non-biological conditions and extends the argument that substances needed for life emerged on Earth may have originally come from outer space. In the paper published in the Journal of Nature Communications, researchers at NASA's Ames Research Center in the US report detecting 2-deoxyribose, which means these are sugars with the OHs removed, sugar component of DNA, and several deoxy sugar derivatives and residues produced by ultraviolet radiation of icy mixtures under standard astrophysical conditions in the laboratory. Hello, darling. Are you going up to the... Okay. They also tested samples from selected meteorites and detected the presence of small deoxy sugars. The quantities were too small to permit unambiguous identification of DNA sugar, but the result is highly significant nevertheless. The shape of our galaxy revealed, this is actually quite interesting, this one. Ingenious research finally reveals the true shapes of the Milky Way. The Milky Way is warped and twisted, a collaboration between the Australian and Chinese astronomers have established. The three-dimensional shape of the galaxy in which Earth resides has been a mystery due to the inherent difficulties in trying to ascertain what any object looks like when it is restricted into making only internal measurements. Most assumptions have proceeded by means of analogy. The galaxy is a spiral, so logic ones, it's probably the same shape as other spiral galaxies. The closest is Andromeda. It's pretty much a pancake. However, we now know it isn't spiral at all, thanks to research led by Richard Degrasse at Macquarie University and Zhenning Chen at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. To accurately measure the shape of the galaxy, the researchers plotted a position of 1,339 cephids, large pulsating stars, each about 1,000 times brighter than the Sun. The interesting thing about this is that the pulsation rate gives its brightness, and therefore its observed brightness and its pulsation rate gives its, working back, gives its a distance. Because the brightness varies only very little, the star functions as a reference point for the galactic mapping exercises. Well, that's incorrect. It's not that the brightness doesn't vary little. It's sort of saying that the pulsation rate versus brightness gives you distance. It's very poorly expressed. By comparing the distances between the Milky Way cephids and those found in other galaxies, the shapes which can be easily confirmed through direct observation. Shen Degrasse and colleagues discovered that our home system becomes increasingly warped and twisted as distances increases from the center. The researchers say that evidence suggests the origin of the warp is associated with torque forces forced by the massive inner disks. I don't know why they're saying this. The research behind this finding was originally published in the journal Nature Astronomy. Call to correct Gulliver's Traveller's food estimate. Now, Gulliver's Travel is something I'm going to have to read by Jonathan Swift, and it's a parody of Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. Researcher finds the famous satirist made mistakes on the Lilliputian physiology. Now, well, God. Calculations of Gulliver's Travels and satiric masterpiece written by Jonathan Swift in the early 18th century are incorrect according to researchers from Japan's University of Tokyo. The novel, as most people know, details the travels of Lemuel Gulliver through the number of lands populated by tiny people, giants, scientists, immortals, and talking horses. Which really means I haven't read it whatsoever, but I really will have to read it. It's a great piece of writing, but Toshio Kori identifies some problems with the mathematics, in particular with the precise calculation of Gulliver's need for 1,724 little Lilliputians to satisfy his hunger. Kori compiled a multifactorial analysis based on the heart and respiration rates and lifespans and blood pressures of people of Lilliput and found the real number is much more conservative, 42. While the other scale, he found the Swiss hero would need just 1/42nd of the typical Brobdingnagian meal to fill his belly. Based on the above finding, the food requirement of the Gullivers in the original text should be corrected after almost 3 centuries. Corey concludes in a paper published in the Journal of Physiological Science. But I really will have to read that. Okay, continuing along here, a picture of 2 beautiful budgies. The boy budgie's brain born in the mating game. Research finds female birds prefer suitors that demonstrate clever behaviour. There's an interesting dating news from China. Brains beat looks in attracting birds, but if you're also a bird, a recent study of the Australian budgerigars by the Chinese and Dutch teams suggests males who reveal their smarts become more attractive in the eyes of female counterparts. That's significant, the researchers say, because it could underline the evolution of cognitive performance of the animals. Perhaps surprisingly, the fitness benefits of recognition as well as underlying selective mechanics have been little studied outside humans. Previous studies with birds have inferred preference of mates, greater cognitive abilities based on secondary behaviours correlated with intelligence such as song. However, this does not directly address the role of cognitive ability on mate choice. In the new study, the researchers examined whether female budgerigars alter their preference to males after observing potential suitors' ability to do something clever that his rival couldn't do, and they did. The study was reported in a paper published in the journal Science. Changing the way to design sensor. This is interesting. US engineers have a 3D printed piezoelectric material. Oh, that's interesting. If you use voice activated software like phones, iPhone Siri, or voice to text, tiny little brittle pieces of crystals or ceramics are converting vibrations of your voice into electrical impulses. Now, researchers at Virginia Tech in the US have developed a method to custom design materials that could replace the delicate crystals and ceramics that were previously the only materials able to convert pressure and electricity, that is known as the piezoelectric effect. So pressure goes to voltage, you measure the voltage and it goes across. These materials are smart and they can sense stress and monitor impact in any direction. Quote, we can tailor the architecture to make them more flexible and use them, for instance, as energy harvesting devices. Oh, God, that's stupid. Wrapping around any arbitrary curvature. We can make them thick and light, stiff, or energy absorbing. Previously available crystals and ceramic piezoelectric materials can only work in certain directions. Orientations because of the atomic structure. A 3D ink designed by Zing's team copies the natural lattice of the crystal, but allows the orientation to be changed around. The minerals can be printed using UV light in a thickness only a fraction of the diameter of a human hair. The possibilities for this goes well beyond the voice activation. While previous piezoelectric materials were limited by their stiffness and delicacies, needing a clean room for manufacturing, the robust and flexibility of the new process means Zhang and his team envisioned the use of materials as sensors for nearly anything. The paper detailing the team's work was published in the journal Nature Materials. Well, there you go. I'm a bit sceptical of that. Australia's fearsome marsupial land. Tachelocarnifex had a huge jaw, sharp teeth, retractable claws, and a feet like a possum. Okay, I think it's pretty famous that the big cats, like I think it's the cheetahs, they don't necessarily have retractable claws. A new fossil found enabled the construction of the first complete skeleton of the extinct marsupial animal Thylacocarnifex. The bones, which include the first full-length tail and collarbones, do not previously known to exist, have opened up at a window to how the prehistoric beast's bizarre features made the deadly predator, according to a report published in the journal PLOS Online. Whatever that stands for. Much like the platypus, Ornithopithecus anacus, which is a giant thing, the marsupial lion had a weird mashup of features. So the platypus and the echidna, which has got a little beak, amazingly. It's amazing, the echidna. So echidna is an anteater. Weighing more than 100 kilograms, it was roughly the size of a modern-day jaguar, but unlike a jaguar or its African namesake, lion namesake, the Thylacocarnifex was a pouched marsupial related to other anthropine archons such as the kangaroo koala and the extinct thylacine. Its jaw, estimated to be the most powerful of any animal, bore chisel-like front teeth and fused cheek, reminiscent of a pair of gardening secateurs. Okay, so it's cuts. And the likes of which aren't seen in any other mammal. The muscular forearms were topped off with fearsome hook claws, and these were retractable. Another unique feature is not seen in any other marsupials, and not necessarily mammals either. Big hunting mammals. Counting the physiological costs of climate change, this is a large article, and there's no author for now. This is by Helen Berry, works at the intersection of global warming and mental health. She discusses her work with Lauren Fudge. So it's written by Lauren Fudge. going across. When Helen Berry learns that I am the same age as one of her children, she apologizes for the situation her generation has created. Quote, I didn't know it, but I've been implicit in it, she tells me. I feel terrible about it. I really do. It's no world to leave him. The professor is a local professor of climate change and mental health at the University of Sydney, where she explores the complex ways in which climate change, disasters and place influence mental health and well-being. And we can do to adapt and to protect ourselves and what we can do. Her career started in a very different place. Born in North London, she first went to the University of Scotland to study languages. An Australian boyfriend brought her to Canberra at age 24, and she's stayed there ever since, except obviously going to Sydney. Stayed here, not in Canberra, but there. A graduate program led her to work in public service for a decade, where she became fascinated by leadership and management. She enrolled in a few psychology subjects and you ended up completing a second undergraduate degree with honours. Then, as large groups began to be interested to interest her more than individuals, she started a PhD in epidemiology, which is group work, groups of people. Her research began to intersect with the climate change during the postdoc at ANU's National Centre for Epidemiology at the Population Health. This is a beautiful little track. One of my sergeant friends used to work there, and she used to have great conversations with him. Sergeant Edie, where she met Tony McMichael, the late epidemiologist who alerted the world to the health effects of climate-induced crisis. Quote, climate change is not just about disruption to the local economy or loss of jobs and loss of iconic species, he once said. It's actually about weakening the foundations of life support systems that we depend on as a human species. Berry took the idea and extended it to mental health. She's one of the few pioneers in the field, she says, still very stigmatized and hugely underfunded. The research into the effect on climate change on human health has steadily climbed over the past decade, while the equivalent research into mental health has plateaued, even though climate-induced disasters are already wreaking havoc on the mental health of many. Climate change does cause mental health problems or create new categories of mental orders, she says, but exacerbating existing problems and creating risk. It is increasing the frequency and intensity of weather-related disasters and exposing more people to extreme events and ramifications such as food shortages, power cuts and damage to public infrastructure, transport and agricultural lands and sacred places. Oh, there you go. Those with underlying risks such as existing health and mental issues or those living in poverty are put under greater strains, leading to a greater prevalence of psychological problems such as anxiety, depression, grief, stress, trauma, and even suicide. This means, of course, that certain groups are disproportionately affected depending on whether they live, their social political resources, and their wealth. Quote, we did a study in Queensland Health following the 2010-11 Queensland flood. Berry said, what we found was that if you lived in a poor area, you were 2 to 3 times more likely than people living in a wealthy area to get flooded in the first place, and if you were flooded, you were twice as likely to be traumatized as a result of being flooded. So you had a double risk factor. The tricky thing is that we need good mental health to effectively deal with and respond to our changing world, yet the effects of climate change take these mental tools away from us. So can we prevent and minimize the psychological impacts of climate change? There are many potential answers, including giving affected communities adequate warning before disaster or weather events, providing high-quality training support to first responders, including emergency services to deal with increased capacity, and managing natural disasters as a cycle rather than an isolated event, with communities recognising that there will be more to come, preparing services, using past experience to plan better for the future. But there may be one thing that may help people more than any logistical solutions. One of the best things you can do for your mental health, other than try not to be born poor in the wrong country or anything like that, is to be well socially connected, said Berry. The people's hopes for her own work will help implementing not just solutions, but also preventative measure, as the science is now good enough to make fine-grained predictions about how different regions will be affected by climate change. She envisions a program where communities are armed with the knowledge of their local risks and given the support and resources to prevent disasters from becoming catastrophic to their environments and their mental health. She applied for funding many times to kickstart the project, but has so far not been successful, likely due to combined power and reluctance to act on climate change and the underfunding and stigmatization of climate health issue, a dual factor there. For now, she is instead focused on international collaborations such as working with the Lancet Countdown, which is tracking the progress and health of climate change to include its indicators in mental health. Quote, Australia is actually the centre of climate change and mental health work. It's just that Australia itself is not interested in it, she says, from a sad, sad laugh. Although climate change has not affected her own mental health, Berry says it does worry her. Quote, people have absolutely no idea how bad it's going to be and how serious the threat is. Her research tells me is, but her research, she tells me, is actually a cause of optimism. Quote, if we do grasp the nettle and start looking for adaptation and mitigation seriously, we could end up with a much more difficult world to, from the perspective of weather and climate, but a much better world in the social political sense, one in which we are happier and healthier. Australia has a long way to go before achieving these pipe dreams, but Berry tries to live her own life in a sustainable way. She walks and cycles where possible and eats a climate-friendly diet, not just because its plant-based diet reduces the emission from industrial agriculture, but also because a healthy body will be an important asset to adapt to a growing future. Oh, God. She adds that she is very aware that the, quote, individual capacity to choose is enormously constrained by who and where they are. Quote, end quote. While individual choices do matter, they're just the tip of the iceberg. The choices made at higher levels of the organization are far more important, Berry says, partly because those levers are bigger. If you pull on those levers, you get much more change, much faster and much more effectively. She gives examples such as government's ability to implement and improve public transport systems where everyone lives within 5 minutes of efficient transport, or to install solar panels on social housing. Although conducting balanced research is her main priority, she says she's also herself an activist. Quote, I definitely see my role as a climate change and health researcher as a political role as well as a scientific role. I'm absolutely partisan. I believe the world and humanity and human health in particular are in great danger, and we have a moral obligation to do something about that, which is really poor for funding, unfortunately. Okay, Technopharm. And this is a picture of the James Webb telescope. It's beautiful. It looks like a starship. Okay. The Time Machine, the new space-borne telescope, will see farther than any man-made instrument seen before and reveal more secrets about the origins of our destiny, says Drew Turney reports. As anyone with even a passing knowledge of the astronomical hardware knows, space-borne telescopes are unaffected by light pollution and light refracting soup of Earth. I love the word soup, that's beautiful. Earth's atmosphere are the most useful tools for figuring out for what's going on in the universe. Well, it's sort of like the opening line of Pride and Prejudice, you know, there's a statement, it's just wits, just plopped from everywhere. I must admit, I don't like that type of statement. For the last few decades, one name, Hubble, has been synonymous with the field, but it's set to change. When the James Webb telescope, JWST, is finally launched, it will feature different instruments set to different parameters, allowing scientists to see further than ever before, even back to the epoch, where the first few galaxies formed a mere couple of 100 million years after the Big Bang. So, I think the end, the realization is, you know, 300,000 years, and then a billion years that starts going across. So I will have to understand. Webb, who died in 1992, was NASA's administrator during the Apollo 11 landing era. As long ago as 1965, he wrote that a large telescope orbiting in space should be a priority of the U.S. Space Agency. If all goes to plan, his vision will become a reality during 2021. My God, it keeps on going out. When JWST arises from the launch pad in French Guiana aboard the Ariane 5 rocket, you can imagine people wetting their pants with that one. As long ago, in 1985, he wrote, it has taken a while to get this stage. The planned launch has been moved every year since 1997. My God, and I would know this. And the cost has risen from $500 million to $10 billion. But wait, the cost, but the weight and the cost will be worth it. Why? We've probably all seen the jaw-dropping images from Hubble of galaxies just like ours that might contain trillions of advanced civilizations, or pretty unlikely. Collectively, there will be trillions. the JWS, because there's only a trillion stars, and whatever you go. So we've got 200 million, and the largest galaxy is a trillion. So instead of the Hubble's near ultraviolet and visible and near infrared spectra, JWS will scan lower frequencies from the log wavelengths of visible light to mid-infrared, letting see the redshift objects that are too old and too far away from existing technology. Leave in mind that we can't even service the Hubble now that the US Space Shuttle and fleet has been mothballed. I think they're losing gyros one by one, so it'd be interesting if this operates on gyros, but I think we'll have to operate on gyros because it's at one of the Lagrange points on the Earth out there. The project of the collaboration between NASA, the European Space Agency, ESA, and the Canadian Space Agency, CSA, with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center developing the hardware and Northrop Grumman's manufacturing. The vehicle, looking like an attached ship, it truly is, from a very friendly galactic invasion force, JWS, will be the size of a tennis court, the actual mirror will be the size of a tennis court. The five-layered sun shield covered in Captain, a proprietary polyamide film that will keep infrared light from the heat for the sun, the moon, and Earth, and vehicle's own electronics affecting the mirrors. The main 6.5 meter wide mirror comprises of 18 hexagonal patterns. 18, so that's 6, and then I'm just trying to think. 6, and then, oh yeah, okay, that's 18. No, that's 6. 3 sixes here, I've got it. Yeah. Okay, the former instruments are packed, driver systems actuators control each panel individually through up to 6 degrees of movement, position and curvature. Curvature is the main thing, which will let the mission controllers make incredibly fine adjustments to set the directional focus. 4 main instruments are packed into a box at the back of the primary mirror. The box at the back of the primary mirror? Oh yeah, okay. So you've got the primary mirror, the secondary mirror, and that's behind it. Cassegrain mount, as opposed to Newtonian mount. So a Cassegrain mount is that the mirror reflects back through a hole in the center of the main mirror and allows your optics to be behind there. The spectrometer is a tool that lets us repurpose the visible light into a spectrum that reveals properties about the chemical composition of the object. The near-infrared camera is the primary visible light imager. The fine guidance center, near-infrared imager, and the slitless spectrometer, my God, I wonder what a slitless spectrometer is, or the FG, NIRS, as always, NASA has, could take a leaf out of Apple's book when it comes to naming stuff. Let the platform target an object with high precision so instruments can stay focused on long enough to gather as much data as possible. Surely this is the gyroscopes. The mid-infrared instruments, MIRI, is a time machine that will be redshifted light from distant galaxies. That's the time machine because it allows you to see further. So with time, things redshift. So it's not a time machine itself, but it allows you to see back. The JWS, so your leg is 3 nanoseconds in the past, just to put you there. It's easily in 6 nanoseconds back. The JWS will technically orbit the sun rather than the Earth. Yeah, okay. 14 days after the launch, the secondary mirror will be deployed and the whole thing will be ready for action, but it won't reach its destination, the second Lagrange point, until a month of flight. 1.5 million kilometers from us, in the opposite direction of the sun, the combined gravitational pull of the Earth and the sun will keep just in orbit, moving slightly faster than us, to stay in line with as it peers onwards into deep space. Okay, is that Lagrange point number 2, is it? Just within. Oh, it's the second Lagrange point. Okay, that's allowed. You can do that one. Under the side of the sun shield facing Earth contains solar panels. The enclosure that will hold a rolled-up sunshield during launch. The spacecraft bus containing the electrical and drive systems, the antenna to communicate with us back at home, and more. What we'll see. The more selective artifact of 100 than anything that's come before, including Hubble, JWST will end what's been called the Dark Ages. Okay, that's a bit... So the Dark Ages is between recombination, which is, was it 35,000 years or 300,000? I just have to remember the dates. So there's a time when we haven't formed stars, so there's a point there between realization where galaxies haven't formed. We may have to see in the Dark Ages, I would expect. We're able to see artifacts from the period which began between 500 billion million years and a billion years after the Big Bang, when galaxies and quasars began to coalesce and form out of the chemical soup. Generally, well, atomic soup, I don't think it's chemicals, giving us a clearer view of the objects, will let us compare them with the more recent examples, such as giant spirals, ellipses, and elliptical galaxies. It would be giant spiral and elliptical in our own home, giving a better idea of how galaxies are born and evolved. We'll also be able to let us see the giant clouds of gas and dust that normally obscure stars and planets as they form, giving us more clues about the makeup of chemical conditions of like atmospheres. From there, it might be a hop, step, and a jump to seeing a building blocks of amino acids, oh god, and proteins, wherever their local equivalents are, in action elsewhere in the universe, maybe peeling the lid off the formation of life itself. I couldn't but say that one. It's a bit sad when they go too far. We're 36 minutes in. And this is Astrid Katie. She is a fantastic commuter. These are fantastic commuters. Katie Mack is a theoretical astrophysicist who focuses on finding new ways to learn about the early universe and fundamental physics. Dark energy is, without a doubt, the weirdest thing in the universe. I agree with you. Despite being present in every corner of the cosmos and dominating its evolution, dark energy is far outside our best existing theories of physics that we're still trying to figure out if it's something in the universe or just a basic property of space itself. And it would be nice to know a bit more about it, and because if you look ahead long enough at the timescale, the dark energy will almost certainly destroy the universe and everything in it. Here's an analogy of how dark energy works. Imagine you throw a baseball up in the air, and the baseball and the Earth are standing in for galaxies moving apart from each other, expanding universe. And you throw the is the expansion set off by the Big Bang. And this is one of the things, isn't that? She's a model. You imagine she's got thing, and then she introduces the model, which is so good. Now, because the baseball and the Earth have mass, I'm just going to see if I can read a bit more about this author. Okay, Katie Mack is a theoretical astrophysicist. She's assistant professor at the North Carolina University, where she is also a part of the leadership in public science cluster. So I don't know if she's a US citizen. Beautiful writing. Now, because both the baseball and the Earth have mass, gravity wants to pull them back together. No matter how hard you throw, even if you have an inhumanly good arm, throw the ball fast enough to escape the Earth entirely, gravity will still slow the ball down at some level. Maybe the ball will fall back down. Maybe it will coast through the space forever. But it won't do is suddenly speed up and shoot off into the sky, defying gravity in its truest sense of term. But that's what the universe is doing. After a nice long period of reasonable post-Big Bang slowing, about 5 billion years ago, the expansion of the universe began explicably speeding up. Whatever is causing it to happen, we call it dark energy. The dark in dark energy just refers to the fact that we can see the dark energy and have no idea what it actually is. But might as well be reference to what it does to our cosmos. A universe whose expansion is accelerating as one given galaxy is relentlessly driven apart from each other. Space on a whole gets darker, emptier and colder. And the lack of interaction stars galaxies, the supply of fuel and new stars. Stars die, matter decays, and eventually the cosmos is devoid of all structure, with only trace amounts of radiation wandering aimlessly through the void. This is rather bleak, lonely Dumont known as heat death. But it could be much worse, much worse. The standard explanation of dark energy is a cosmological constant, an idea Einstein first proposed in 1917 as an added term to his equations of gravity to explain why the universe appeared to be static instead of collapsing on itself. When expansion was discovered soon after, the cosmological constant was the term was thrown out, only to be dragged out again decades later as a possible culprit for accelerated expansion. A cosmological constant that fits the data at least as well as any explanation, but from a theoretical viewpoint is a mess. It represents vacuum energy, a kind of minimum energy inherent in empty space. One whose density stays constant no matter how much the universe expands, but magnitude is all wrong. The best theoretical calculation we can do from the particle physics theories is to suggest the vacuum energy should be at least 120 orders of magnitude, so that's 10 by 10, 120 times stronger. And we know that this is quantum mechanical version of vacuum energy. This is the Casimir effect, because it's been detected experimentally, causing tiny metal plates to move very, very slightly together by the Casimir effect. It's not tiny plates, they're large plates, but they're a very small distance apart. So when you create a slice of nothing, which is beneath a quantum mechanical nothing, you restrict the formation of quasi-particles to come in. So these plates, if you bring them closer together, they'll experience another force. They come really close. I don't know. I've had it done. But if cosmological constants were strong enough to make the whole theoretical story fit together, it would more than slowly isolate galaxies at a time. It would violently rip them apart, structures of the universe. So we're left with a conundrum. It would be, in some ways, be easier to explain the universe with no cosmological constant than a bizarrely small one. And there have been explanations of dark energy that don't involve Einstein's term at all. Some of these allow dark energy density to be changing over time. In fact, some recent observations of the expansion of the universe as deduced from very distant exploding stars and supermassive black holes have lent support to this idea. Unfortunately, dynamical dark energy comes into its own issues if dark energy gets more and more powerful over time. As some of the observations have suggested, it too can tear the universe apart. So perhaps we should hold out hope for heat death, that we might go gentle into that good night. At least it might remind us to take a moment to appreciate the beautiful cosmos around us as while we still can. That's a beautiful story, so I'll have to find out more about it. I'm going to finish at this stage and upload this first Cosmos magazine.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.